Once again, welcome back. This is The Lives of Writers. Thanks for listening. I am the publisher of Autofocus Books and producer of this podcast, Michael Wheaton. Today's episode of The Lives of Writers is hosted by Jason McCall. Jason McCall is the author of the essay collection Raised by TV Sets from Autofocus Books, and the poetry collections What Shot Did You Ever Take, co-written with Brian Oliu, A Man Ain't Nothing, Two-Faced God, Motherless Child, Dear Hero, I Can Explain, and Silver. He and PJ Williams are the editors of It Was Written, poetry inspired by hip-hop. Coming up very soon, you'll hear Jason in conversation with Brooke Champagne. Brooke Champagne is the author of Nola Face, A Latina's Life in the Big Easy. Her writing appears widely in literary journals and has received various awards, including the inaugural William Bradley Prize for the essay for her work, Exercises. And her essays have been selected as notables in several editions of Best American Essays. All right, let's get to it. This is Jason McCall's conversation with Brooke Champagne.
So one thing that's interesting about this year, so our semester ended a couple of weeks ago at University of Alabama, where I teach, and summer session is starting. This is the first summer I've been teaching for 22 years. It might be like the third summer ever. I don't teach summer school, so that's great. And it's the first summer ever my kids have a camp. So they started camp today. And so I just can't tell you how. Now, I've been back and forth to my daughter's camp a couple times because she needed things. She needed fizzy water. She's not even that precious, but like she, you know, it's the start of something new, a brand new camp. So so my summer ahead is looking like I hope that I'm going to write because, you know how it is. Like, it's hard to find time, you know, and I need my kids to get out of my face.
Yeah, that's always a dangerous promise. One of the things I've always learned is I never write down my summer goals because I don't want to lie to myself when it comes down to the end of summer. But you mentioned summer camp. So are these general summer camps? What type of camps are the kids at right now?
There are two different ones. So my son is starting kindergarten in the fall. So there's like a jump start early education, sort of like a pre-K adjacent kind of thing that goes for a month, goes through June. So he's attending that at his elementary school he's already at, which is great. It's like 30 seconds from my house. And my daughter's attending like a kind of general camp, but it's sort of academics. It's called I Dream Big Academy, and it's really lovely. It's at the magnet school. I don't all know what they're doing, but they serve them breakfast and lunch. So that to me, I was like, yes, it's also affordable. So, I mean, affordable summer camp, that doesn't happen. So they're both for June. I mean, I have like a discrete writing window, which the end of it is June 27th. And after that, I'm on my own. That's when both their camps end. So, yeah.
All right. Yeah. So kids get fed and kids get out of the way for a little while.
Yes.
Sounds like a good deal.
Brilliant.
But for you, you mentioned this is your first time, you said in 22 years or so of teaching, when, you know, one of the few times when you're not normally teaching in the summer. And so for you, when it comes down to kind of, if this summer is in some ways kind of an aberration, this summer is kind of maybe a standout. And you mentioned the idea of kind of cutting out some writing time, cutting out some things. Talk a little bit about, though, when it comes down to maybe kind of what it's like to have this new space for summer, what it's like to have maybe this new space to start try to plan things. What's the transition been like for you?
I think, although I'm not teaching, I kind of am I structure it the same way kind of throughout the year. I try to be someone who, my whole writing life over the past couple of decades, it's always worked a little differently. But I think part of my winning strategy has been to just, for me, to have a more consistent writing routine, not the same time every day, but just sort of always be touching my stuff, always returning to the thing I'm working on. So, and actually I brought this with me today. I started last summer. Listeners can't see, but I've made little calendars where it's sticker charts basically for every month. And if I do like what I'm supposed to do writing wise in the day, I give myself a sticker and my sort of goals for myself. I'm like you, like, I don't like to have like a big plan. Like I'm going to have, you know, 50 pages of my manuscript done or whatever, but I do like to sort of set daily goals, which is an hour today. And it doesn't have to, you know, an hour today. And if I can do that, I get my sticker. I feel good about myself. So I've been doing that for a little over a year. And that's just a way to keep me accountable. It's just given me more, I just don't want to let myself down and I want to get my damn sticker. So I just make sure to do it like, you know, my 5 days a week. And that's kind of what I do. My routine is, I can't work on the weekends because I have children who are around. And also I don't know. Do you like to work on the weekends? I'm not like a fan of that.
I try not to, but I'll tell myself I'm a bit of a tinkerer. And so, you know, if it means me kind of touching something a little bit, I don't mind doing that. But the idea of whether it's a weekend or a day in the week, if I can kind of buy myself a day off, which might mean, you know, this is a day when I don't look at my grade book, or this is a day when I don't look at the assigned reading, or this is a day when I don't look at my writing project, because I've earned the right to do something else. And it sounds crazy that you have to kind of earn the right from yourself to do things. When you talk about kind of giving yourself stickers, or for me, earning the right to tell myself I don't have to follow my own schedule. But talking about that transition period a little bit, if I'm not mistaken, you just finished up your first year as an assistant professor. And again, I know when we met, which is kind of in the Stone Ages, about 15 years or so, I guess maybe. I know when it comes up, you were at the University of Alabama in a different position. And so can you talk a little bit about your career trajectory, like how we made it to this point of maybe, you know, being a teacher and a writer, maybe with a summer off, or how this new position as an assistant professor maybe lines up with some of what you've been doing in the past?
Oh, that's, do you want me to spill the tea?
That's up to you. Yeah. If we want to go in chronological order, naming names, if we're doxing people, I'm not the boss here.
I don't dox. No. And then also I was thinking like, oh my gosh, how much time do we have? I'll give an abridged version. I have been teaching since 2003, so that's a while. So this will be my 22nd year teaching, coming this fall, I believe, if that's the math. And I spent most of that time, after being a graduate student, being either an adjunct instructor or a full-time instructor. And I don't know what the listening public knows. If you don't know academe, that just meant that our contracts were renewable, but it's kind of year by year. You don't get many of the benefits, and you don't have a pay structure increase. That's kind of the big thing too. Anyway, so as Nola Face, my debut memoir and essays, essay collection, I don't know what to call it, but I think it's both of those things. As that was about to come out, I mean, I got the contract in 2022. So, and I kind of had a feeling that it was going to be contracted in 2021. So this was many, you know, it's, as you know, Jason, like book production takes a while. So as I knew I would be out in the market, I sort of like leaned heavily on, I need to apply for jobs, because that the structure I've been in so long as an instructor, it's like, and Jason, you can speak to this as well, having done it for years, it's not tenable. It's not a forever job. And, you know, and I know it is a forever job for a lot of people. So I want to like be careful. Like, I know a lot of people do it for 30 years and 40 years, but I just had this book coming out and I was like, I kind of got to see what's out there. So I applied for a bunch of jobs. I told my chair that I was applying for jobs and he was like, whoa, we gotta keep you here. But also, and this is the thing that's weird, Jason, like, it's not about your direct supervisor, your chair, saying, you're a great employee, we want to keep you, I'm going to make that happen. It's academia. So there's like four people ahead of him who like up to the provost who have to make these decisions. Like, do we want this person? So it ended up being this big thing that I had to apply for jobs. And I basically had to get one job in order to be offered the position here. So I secured four offers so that I could, and I was like, bam, do y'all want me? And they were like, yes, yes, we do. So that was like, that was the process of spring 2023 of just flying across the country, applying for jobs, trying to get them. But also at the same time, and I have to say this because there were some great jobs that I got. And the plan wasn't always like, I'm going to stay here at Alabama. I kind of, I kept an open mind, like what else is out there? And there were other great jobs out there, but I'm originally from New Orleans. That's the place I write from. And my tagline for Tuscaloosa is always Tuscaloosa, only 4 hours from New Orleans. That's terrible. That's not fair to Tuscaloosa, but it is.
But it
I just wanted to access. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I know for me, again, I did my undergrad there back in 2003 to 2007. And for a lot of people, one of the selling points was, you know, New Orleans is a train ride away. And yeah, obviously, yeah. Even as the college town grows and develops mm-hmm. into what it is now, it's still a train ride away. But, you know, for you, you mentioned the idea of teaching as, you know, you mentioned the hoops that you maybe jumped through when it comes down to, again, starting as an adjunct. And, you know, I always like to say for me, starting as a part-time teacher, I got fired every semester. And so
rehired the
right.
next semester.
And so maybe, you know, I've been fired more times than anybody in my family now. They just never knew it because they always thought, oh, well, you know, Jason teaches at a university that sounds mm-hmm. prestigious, but they don't
exactly.
realize I'm getting fired and rehired basically every year for the first, you know, 3 years. But so for you mentioning the hoops that you've had to jump through, what makes teaching worth it for you? Like, how did you stumble into teaching? I know for me, I didn't really know I wanted to be a teacher until it was part of my graduate school.
Yeah.
Obviously, like a teaching assistantship. I didn't really know what I was going to do. I got in front of a classroom and realized I like talking shop with people. And I didn't mind being in front of a group of 20-year-olds or in some cases, there were even older students yeah. who were older than me. I didn't mind being in front of the room and talking shop with them. So what got you into teaching, whether it was something you wanted to do, something you fell into, what made you take this path?
I think it's it sounds a lot similar to yours, but I have to say when I got my acceptance to graduate school and I read the letter, and I've been thinking about that a lot recently because of another essay I'm writing. When I read, which I already knew this, but like seeing it in print, when it said, you will have a graduate teaching assistantship, and this will require first that you're, you know, maybe possibly a GA first, a graduate assistant for research, but you eventually, like, part of this degree is that you will teach. And Jason, that was the one thing. I mean, I was like, I'm going to grad school because this is the thing. I had no other talent. I love storytelling. I love writing. Like, there was just nothing else that I could do. I never really thought, I'm not like, I don't come from practical people and I'm not a practical person. I wasn't thinking like, what will my job be after I get an MFA? I was just thinking like kind of year by year. And I just thought, how am I going to teach? I can't do this. I was someone as an undergrad, you might not believe me, people don't believe me. I wasn't like I wasn't participative in class. I just thought, smarter people were around me. I would let them talk. I would take it in. I would take notes. I didn't really talk. So I thought, how am I going to teach? But it's the same as you that I got up there. Of course, I was terrified. I still get terrified when I do this 22 years later. But I just thought, like, this is kind of like is a conversation. It's like what are your ideas? How does that influence my ideas? Also, my brain works like I'm not like diagnosed with anything, but something like I'm really bad in a fight because I just feel the anger and I don't like think through why I'm angry. Like I can't articulate. Same thing happens in the classroom where like if a student says something that's compelling for any reason, whether it's like something atrocious they've said or something brilliant, it takes me a while to process it. So sometimes I just literally have to say like, you know, you just said something I'm gonna have to think about and get back to you next week. Like I just don't even, like I'm gonna write this down. But obviously when I'm first teaching, I don't know how you've experienced this. When I was first teaching, I would be like, changing subject, like just like moving on. I'm awkward. This is weird. But all of that's to say that all of it was like exciting and thrilling. And I was like wanting to get better at it because I did, you know, as I don't know if you agree with the Karen Gardner theory that everyone is shit at teaching for the first three. I think she's like says 3 or 4 years. Like everyone's bad, pretty much. I want to get good. Just kind of like with writing, like the more you do it, like I just feel like, and that's how, like, I kind of feel like I've been growing as a writer and teacher concurrently and that they've been feeding each other. And that's sort of, that's why I wanted to stick with teaching, because I felt like the closer I was getting to like learning how to communicate and learn from students, I was also doing that in my writing as well, like communicating with myself better than I'd been doing.
Yeah. And I think working a job, you mentioned for teaching, like everybody being, you mentioned Karen Gardner was getting like one of our old bosses at the University of Alabama. And I think, you know, she was one of the people who was not like when I moved from being a full timer to a part timer, mm-hmm. I think she was one of the people who vouched for me. And it's in one of those spaces when you're in these weird academic spaces, you never really know who's paying attention to you or, you know, if the person who says something nice to you really likes you or if the person who doesn't really talk mm-hmm. to you hates you or vice versa. And that can be, of course, also complicated when you start to throw in stuff like race and gender and, mm-hmm. You know, some of that comes into the book that we're going to talk about, Nola Face. But when you mentioned the idea of kind of being good at something, I think it is, in some cases you mentioned growing concurrently. And I think sometimes there is the idea of kind of what's your core skill and whether it is like, you know, I know writers and teachers who are geniuses, smarter than I'll ever be. And they have that core genius to just build off of, where if you let them talk about anything they know, you're going to hear the smartest thing you've ever heard. Mm-hmm. But then, of course, there's the persona. Where how does that persona show up in a classroom? And, you know, if you forgive me, I'm going to kind of turn this conversation to pro wrestling a little bit. Imagine
sure.
that.
Yeah.
You know, there's the idea of how people present themselves and what character you are. And, you know, and there's the old pro wrestling idea that the best successful characters are some type of elevated version of yourself. You find some version of yourself and you bring it on stage. And I think teaching in a lot of ways isn't too far away from being on stage. I think, you know, I can compare it to pro wrestling or I can compare it to stand-up comedy. In a lot of ways, when you hear people talk about how you get on stage and you figure out how to kind of command the room when you figure out what parts of yourself to bring in. And so for you, teaching, when you mentioned the idea of kind of being bad at it, whether it is time management, whether it is figuring out assignments, all of these things. For you, when you mentioned the idea of kind of being bad to begin with versus now, kind of what did you feel like was the thing that maybe kept you in teaching during those early crappy days of teaching? Yeah. And even now, when you walk into a room, you know, what do you feel like makes the kind of Brooke Champagne classroom work?
That's, I love this question. And by the way, you are one of those to me genius people when you're talking, I'm just like, I want to listen. And I'm happy to say that I'm not one of those people. Like I don't have the genius, but I feel like I do have the persona. And to answer your question, I think that's what I lacked at the beginning was knowing what I had to offer, what I had to bring to the table. What was the Brooke Champagne in the classroom? Concurrently, I didn't know who the Brooke Champagne on the page was, this elevated version of myself that I could like construct that was both the me and the not me, as Virginia Woolf said, I think in the morning essay, like how to be oneself and not at the same time. That's the dilemma. I didn't know how to do that. I didn't know how to do either that on the page or performing as a teacher. And I think that, yes, I've learned a lot of things over the years that have made me better as a teacher. And part of that is some things you mentioned, like organization, like going in with like a really solid plan. And at the same time, knowing that we can completely, depending on what happens in that space, we might go off book and learning to deal with that, learning to deal with the things that happen when what you've planned does not bear out. But I think the thing that the strongest thing is that I learned how to just be comfortable with myself and know that what I'm offering is just the Brooke Champagne style is really storytelling and listening and being collaborative and having everyone kind of coming in together, making sure that we're all working towards something. Like, I'm really into collaboration in the class, because if it's just me directed, then it's a mess. This is why I never really liked teaching literature courses. You're probably, I mean, I know you've taught, you know, those classes brilliantly before. I wasn't really great because I don't like lecture, because I'm not, like I said, I'm not one of these people who like, oh, I'm just now going to tell you all I know about Huck Finn. That's going to be like a short lecture, because I want to hear what other people say and then be able to come back. And so that's why the creative writing class, any writing classroom, I think for me is more comfortable, because we can make the text together and then we can talk about the text together. And that's sort of like and my main thing that I hope that I offer is, like, honestly, just love and support. I don't think the writing classroom should be dictated by, like, oh, I have this style and now you do it. Now you should try to be, if you want to write well, write like me. And I swear to God, Jason, when I first started teaching, I think I did that. I was like, here's examples of my work, which by the, oh my God, in 2003, if I was showing my shit, oh my God, I'm like so embarrassed for those children of 20 years ago who are not children, because they're like 3 years younger than me, which is crazy.
No, it happens. Time moves, sadly, but, no, speaking of time, I think in a lot of ways for me, again, mentioned like how we come to the classroom, where I have two brains, where I do have my creative writing brain. When you mentioned, it's like, I love collaboration. I love talking shop, but my first love was ancient history. There's like when you mentioned the idea of kind of teaching classes that are more lecture heavy, where I can remember, like, there's the history classroom where there is the authority in front of the room drawing timelines. And if you let me get into a literature classroom, I still, to this day, will have my timeline days, and I can see my students kind of eyes glaze over, but I just kind of coach them through it. It's like, we're going to get to the literary analysis, but I have to tell you how the First Crusade gets us to this Shakespeare poem. Trust me. And a lot of that does come, and, you know, one of the biggest compliments or put downs I ever got in a student evaluation was a student wrote, you know, Professor McCall would be a great history teacher. And I don't know if that meant I could be a great history teacher and an English teacher, or I needed to change my career path. But mentioning the idea of kind of approaching things, and you've mentioned the idea of kind of growing as a writer and as a teacher. Obviously this podcast is The Lives of Writers. And so let's talk about writing a little bit. And so for you, again, I've got some of the answers because I've read the book, Nola Face, and you mentioned the idea of your journey with writing. But tell us a little bit about how you came to writing, whether it was through school, through outside of class activities, through family, through friends. How did you stumble on writing? And when did you figure out that writing was something that you might end up doing long term?
I think I'm still working. Am I doing it long term? I've tried to quit writing, by the way. So, like, you know how people try to quit drinking, try to quit sugar? I tried to quit writing, like, very earnestly several times. Like, I'm not doing this anymore. And then I did this, like, post MFA, by the way. I remember one time really vividly, I was like, I'm quitting. And then what happened, Jason, is I would just, like, something would happen, or I'd make an observation. I'd be like, oh, I got to write that down. In fact, I made my proclamation of quitting writing by writing it down in a journal. So, like, just that's all to say that, like, you know, I'm a little full of shit. But to the discovery of it, I think it's one of those things that, like, it's not, it has been, like, sort of lifelong. I think really for me, it really starts with reading. I was just always, and I know you were this way too. I read your lovely essay collection, Raised by TV Sets, also this year. Our books kind of came out around the same time. So I was thinking about your trajectory as a writer compared to mine. And I just, like, always read, just always. And then I think sometime in high school, like, I took a class that was not a creative writing class, but just sort of like, oh, do literary analysis, but make it creative. And that just really, that was exciting to me. And at that time, my mother, we moved, I moved from the East Bank of New Orleans to the West Bank. And going through old stuff, we found old journals of mine. And like, I started taking writing seriously. I'm using my little scare quotes here. When I was like 7 years old, because I was like daily making diary entries and writing about how I hated my mother and how I hated my stepfather. And it was just basically a litany of people I hated and the reasons why. And then crossing it out later and saying like, well, no, I like my mom now. I never did turn back and love my stepfather. Which is fine. But so when we came across that later in high school, my mom was like, dude, you're funny. You're like a funny, strange little kid. You'd always like be writing stuff down. So that observation just kind of like stuck with me. Like I always went to the page, not like out of any. And then by the way, oh my God, I don't know if you experienced this, but like when I went to college and I was like other students in creative writing classrooms, and I don't mean to like talk smack about just the general creative writing student, but I had a lot of my peers were like, I'm writing to save the world. And I was like, what? Like, no, I'm not. That is like not, I would not know how to begin to save the world. Just like trying to figure out very small things, like why a boy doesn't like me or why my father like abandoned me, whatever. Like, I'm just trying to like write these things, but I'm not trying to save the world. So I guess that's a long-winded kind of way of saying I always had writing as something to do. And I think it was sometime in college where I realized it was there were classes. And I was like, oh, I want to do this in class and also do this outside of class. I just kind of want to do this. I don't know what that means, where it'll go. I didn't think like, I'm definitely going to write a book someday. That kind of came later. But I just knew that this was a practice that I wanted to continue.
And for you, I think you mentioned kind of the dual nature of kind of the best and worst energy of the creative writing classroom, where there's, you know, I'm going to save the world with my writing. No one has ever heard of my views when it comes down to writing about my deep, deep, dark soul. have you heard of this thing called
it's
capitalism?
Terrible.
Let me tell you about it. But there's also the idea of I'm writing to save myself. Yeah. And something like when you can get kind of those energies to kind of mix and mingle, that's kind of part of some of the sloppy fun of, you mentioned undergraduate workshops. And a lot of times we like to maybe lie to ourselves that we've grown out of some of these early impulses. But as nonfiction writers, we tell on ourselves all the time that we haven't grown out of much of this. But for you with writing, you mentioned the idea of the academic side of things, but then you also mentioned journaling at home. And so for you as writing, was writing something that was like something you did yourself, or did you have like other family members, other friends who did writing or who did other art, or was it something that you found and you felt like this is mine and kind of I'm the writer, as opposed to maybe having a group of writers who did it together and shared work together, things like that?
Yeah, I did not have that. There were no writers that like in my vicinity. So that's why it's weird that, well, in a way it's weird that I would just like, I just randomly was bought a diary and used it, you know, like it was just like one of the ones where it's supposed to have a lock and the lock didn't work. But I found out later that my father, who plays a significant role in The Little Face, and we can talk about his reaction to it if you want, because he read it and it was,
oh wow,
it's kind of funny. Yeah. Oh, it's yeah. But he was a writer. He was an English major. He's someone. He's just like this person. He quit college a year before graduating because, and this is sort of like, I'm trying, like early 70s. He's just like, what am I going to do with an English degree? He had, you know, an A average. He excelled. And he was just like, this is, you know, so then he like became a salesman and just like did not, he never got a degree, but he was a writer. And I only know this because he vaguely told me sometime in my, like at some point, but it just became a thing between us when he learned that because we didn't really talk in college, when he learned I was an English major and graduated and was going to graduate school for writing, he kind of was like, there was a tacit thing where he was like, we don't need to talk about this, but yes, I've written. And I had a manuscript, but like, I don't know what happened to it, those sorts of things. So it's something that we didn't talk about, but like it was there. So, I mean, I guess it is something that was inherited, although he certainly never encouraged me. Like I might be the opposite. And yeah, it's not like a thing that it was ever fostered in any way other than reading. And he did, I have to say, really foster reading for me. He read a lot and he bought me a lot of books. So that was a great gift.
Yeah. And mentioning kind of the lead up to Nola Face, your essay collection. And for us, again, this is what we're here to celebrate in a lot of ways. And again, was the official publication date May or April?
April 1st. It was April Fool's Day, which I feel like is perfect for me because yes.
Yeah. And so it just came out again from UGA Press. And for this collection, we're going to talk about a few ins and outs of it. I definitely want to hear the family review again from father, their other family members. I think for me, one of the things that I have kind of comfort in is that my parents don't read my work. They're ridiculously supportive and they always have been. But for me, it's always been, you mentioned the offhand conversation having, you know, your dad was like, oh, by the way, I was an English major, where I would have these conversations with my dad after every degree. And even though they supported me, but like during my degree process, no questions asked, of course. But when I'd be back home in Montgomery driving around town, and my dad would just kind of ask, and he, you know, my first degree again was in classical civilization, ancient history. And he's like, So Jay, what did you get a degree in? It's like, it's a little too late for that, but I tell him, it's like, I got a degree in ancient history. I got a degree in classical civilization, ancient Greece, ancient Rome. I try to name people, Julius Caesar, Hannibal. I try to name people he might know. And he says, oh, okay, well, what do you do with that? Again, it's too late to ask this question.
Yes.
But luckily I had a scholarship to go to, you know, my MFA program down in Miami. Finished my MFA program down in Miami, came back home to Montgomery. Same conversation 2 years later. What did you get a degree in? Again, he helped me move down. He came to graduation, but again, that's that question of them.
Yeah.
And I told him, I've got a degree in creative writing. So what do you do with a degree in creative writing? Well, I got a job at the University of Alabama. I didn't tell him it was a terrible part-time job, which is probably worse than any. I probably signed a worse contract than he'd ever signed. And considering he's, you know, a black man who was born in 1956 in Alabama, that says a lot. But my adjunct teaching contract was probably more terrible than any contract he signed. And he spent 30 years in the military. But it was one of those situations where you do get these places where you do get kind of that disconnect between kind of what are you doing. As in some cases, there can be like as a writer, when it comes down to kind of family, when it comes down to that disconnect between kind of how you're living things. And I think in Nola Face, one of the things I really liked about the book was the idea of kind of these constant levels of connection that you're talking about. And this is going to sound like it's a little bit a ways away, but hopefully you can, in creative writing, a lot of times when I talk to my students about art, I talk about the Sistine Chapel, and there's the creation of Adam. And a lot of times I talk about how the fingers are the art. There's the line work that's there. There's the brushstroke, the coloring, all the beauty of it that I'm not an art major. I can't explain, but we can all explain the tension that's in those two fingers. You know, if those two fingers touch, it's a different piece of art.
Yeah.
Those two fingers are across from each other by feet, meters. If they're at one side of the chapel and at the other side of the chapel, that's a different set of energy. But I think one of the things you do in kind of Nola Face is kind of that idea of kind of getting close to something, whether it is close to your own identity, close to family identity, and kind of the tension that comes when you're trying to touch something that maybe you're never going to touch.
Yep.
Or maybe as a reader, we aren't quite sure if you're getting closer or coming further away. So if you walk out of this podcast, you know, I compare your book to Renaissance art. Maybe that's a good review, depending on how you feel about the Renaissance. But I think this is a good introduction to Nola Face as a whole. So I'm going to take a step back a little bit and tell us about Nola Face, how it came about. How did we go from maybe individual essays to this essay collection? What was the timetable? Talk to us.
Oh, I love it. First of all, thank you for that comparison. That's brilliant. And hearing you again, like hearing you talk about that made me think about the tension between the fingers and how I think Nola Face, and I probably a lot of essay collections are about that space between the fingers touching, the idea that like connection, like you said, is almost there, but not quite. Like what's happening in that space? Why aren't they touching? Why isn't it there? So how the book came about is I had no idea what I was doing. Is that okay to say? I've just always written, you know, I told you that I tried to quit, you know, just like quitting smoking. I tried to quit in like 2005, 2006. I think it was after Hurricane Katrina. I was tired. There was a storm. There was a lot of stuff. And I was like, I'm from New Orleans. The city is now screwed. And I just wanted to kind of take care of myself and my family. I was like, I'm quitting. Then I started up again. But I think I started really thinking about that I was an actual essayist in that next decade, maybe early 2010s, 2012, 13. I think after the, let's talk about, you use the weather to talk about this. I think after the tornado that I lived through in Alabama, the 2011 tornado, it was kind of like I was never in danger, but that was a horrific weather event. And I was like, it was just another reminder that everyone dies and I will. And so like, if I want to do this work, I should kind of get down to it. So I started just maybe instead of abandoning essays, just being more stubborn with them, just kind of like doing what your tinkering thing. Like I was just like, I'm just going to tinker for a while. And I just was writing about stuff, family stuff, New Orleans stuff. I think now that I was away from New Orleans for a few years, I could more easily write about it. And I just started, there's no way to say, I didn't know what I was doing. I was fumbling. I was writing in the dark. I was whatever you want to call it. And it really honestly wasn't till the pandemic when I accumulated maybe, I don't know, 13, 14 publications like that were sort of interconnected, not total amount of publications, but just sort of like these essays that were all published. And my husband, Brock, who you know, said, do you think that you have a book? Like, you've published a lot of these things. And I was like, wait, what? What now? So, and I was finishing up, I think I was finishing up the title essay, Nola Face. And it was one of his favorites. And he was just like, I think like this is, you do have a book and I don't know what it is. So he like kind of forced me to come to school and print out all my shit. Like he was like, print out your, you know, your 200 pages of work. And then it was just a matter for me of kind of seeing connections. I mean, I did a whole thing. It would be maybe boring to hear too, but I'll give broad brush. Like I kind of made up my first Excel spreadsheet of all time. My first one where I like listed titles and then was like, what are the themes? What are the first and last sentences? Where are there cross pollinations? And then I realized like I just had a bunch of essays, but I needed like introduction, some interstitials. Like what are the concerns of the book? Like I guess I needed like a way to shake the hand of the reader at the very beginning of the book to say like, this is who I am. This is what I'm trying to do. And so I wrote an introduction. I kind of wrote that last after Nola Face was completed. And just found a way to say like, this is kind of a trajectory of, as you said, I mean, the book could also, if this book title had not been taken already, it would have been We Learn Nothing. I love this book titled We Learn Nothing by Tim Creeder. It's a book of essays that's like, yeah, I just keep doing the same shit over and over again. And this is who I am. This is kind of Nola Face, like a little bit like I learn, I struggle, I get there, and then I unlearn. And it's just about, it's the humanity of being kind of sometimes a moron, but being self-aware about it, I think is crucial.
Yeah,
I don't know if this answers the question.
No, it does. And you mentioned the idea that you said kind of the spreadsheet was the boring part. But also I want to come back to that for me.
Yeah.
Because again, I put my essay collection together again, raised by TV sets, and it was tough for me because a poetry person coming over to nonfiction, and the old school poetry I was taught was, you know, even from my old mentor in graduate school, Maureen Seaton, rest in peace. Like, she would talk about putting together a poetry collection, and she would talk about, you know, print. You mentioned the idea of going and printing out all of your stuff. And that was kind of the old poet's way to print out all the work and lay it on the floor even.
Yeah.
And that was the idea of kind of laying things on the floor and organizing things. And, you know, for me, whether it was laying things on the floor, or for me, sometimes it is the idea of kind of putting everything in a PDF and moving things around and seeing how things talk to each other. And, you know, I didn't really feel like my essay collection was a collection other than just being like a bunch of essays stuffed together until I figured out the organization and until I figured out kind of some of those like chapter headings kind of that I ended up putting in between the different sections of the book. And so when you mentioned the idea of kind of going to that spreadsheet, even though, again, spreadsheets are not the sexy part of writing, but, you know, for you, what, like when it came down to kind of looking at, you know, somebody who wrote essays to thinking, I am writing a book, what happened for you when you began to kind of lay out those themes and when you began to plug those essays into a spreadsheet? How did that help you make the, how did that help make the book more real for you, if that makes sense?
Yeah, no, it does. I think it, it is unsexy to think about spreadsheets, but it, but this is the organization part. It's sort of like, you know, method of madness as part of writing, as part of teaching. Like, you want the excitement of the persona, but also like what reins it in. And I think like doing, printing everything out, seeing or like seeing what potential orders could be like that, that's the reining in part. Like, how's, this has all been in me for all this time. Like, how is other people, how are other readers going to, what are they going to see when they open this? So I think I just started asking really general questions like, why have I been doing this? Why have, I mean, I know that's like crazy, but like, why did I spend 10 years writing this? Like, why did, like, again, very slowly, very, and when I, semi-methodically, but also methodically in discrete essays, but then also like, again, the major project was not something that was in my head. Like, I'm going to write the Latina's like experience of growing up in New Orleans. Like, that's not what I was thinking when I was writing at all. So I needed, I asked myself sort of why did I do this? What do I want readers to get out of it? And then what are like, this is kind of how I came up with the introduction and interstitials. And I think like once I did that, honestly, that sort of helped order the whole book for me, because it was like, why did I write this? And one of the answers, I mean, and a lot of this is for me is, a lot of essaying is just about asking questions, not necessarily getting to the answers. But one of the things was like, I just wanted to figure out why I'm a writer, why I do this, why I'm compelled to come to the page. And I, you know, who am I? Like, who am I? But then also like the smaller categories of like, why am I this type of storyteller? Like, why do I write essays and memoirs? And am I more of an essayist or a memoirist? That was another major concern that I always thought of, like, what does it mean to be a memoirist versus an essayist? And then the other thing, and probably the biggest category of my life, my biggest identifier is like, I like every human, I suffer tragedies, and I just can't help it. It's a thing about myself. Like, when I'm face tragedy, I just have to try to be funny about it. I mean, maybe I haven't, like, I've lost, you know, I've lost a lot of loved ones, and I, not that I'm like cracking jokes at funerals, but I'm saying like anything that I feel that's tragic, like, what is this? Why do I have a compulsion to try to be funny? Like, these were the things that I, like, these questions that I were asking, I was asking. So I feel like when I ask those big questions, it kind of helped me order, like, what comes in the book when. So the first third of the book is much more like identity formation. It's not all childhood stuff, but it is getting to more of that stuff of like, how did I grow up with this bifurcated Latina and white identity and my grandmother and all of her language. And I had these two languages, Spanish and English, that I was always battling. And then later it's, what kind of writer are you trying to be? Are you telling stories? Are you thinking about ideas, and which is whatever? And then finally, tragedy versus comedy. How do I meld both of these together in my work? And that just kind of, for me, those bigger questions kind of helped set these things that were already in place, kind of put them in order. Not, but the Excel spreadsheet is important, because having first and last sentences, or like the idea of what they're doing, connecting essays that way is just really, I have to say, if you are interested, if any listener is interested in writing their life story or part of it, doing that was very helpful to me to figure out where are the connections here? So,
yeah. All right, there's a pro tip: put your life in spreadsheets.
Yeah.
I think they charge like $100,000 for business school to learn how to do spreadsheets, but now we just gave it to you for free.
For free, look at this.
But you know, you mentioned the idea of kind of how you organize the book. You mentioned the idea of kind of the humor in the book. And one of the things I really wanted to talk to you about is craft. Again, this the title of the book is Nola Face, A Latina's Life in the Big Easy. And for a lot of people, the minute you see the word Latina, they've already written the story themselves.
Yep.
And when it comes down to, in a lot of cases, when it comes down to even if we say Latina, if we say, you know, okay, a Latino woman, we've got it figured out. And when it comes down to a lot of minority writers, when it comes down to a lot of female writers, we talk about the heart of the book. We talk about the emotion. We talk about the power of the book. And a lot of times this starts to become really, in some cases, kind of paternalistic after a certain yeah. point, when it almost becomes a pat on the head, like, look at that minority who learned how to spell, let's celebrate them. And we aren't, and there are lots of people with big emotions who can't write as well as you. There are lots of people who try to be funny who aren't as funny as you. There are lots Thank of you. People who try to organize who don't know how to organize a book. We're not here to name and shame, but I think, you know, a lot of cases, conversations about craft don't happen a lot yeah. of times when it comes down to kind of women and minority writers. And so
right.
for you, when it comes down to kind of a craft perspective, whether, you know, I'd be interested to hear whether it was, you know, some of the influences you wanted to bring into the book, or if you have, you know, a favorite essay in the book, a favorite section of the book, maybe a part of the collection that was hard to put together and then the light bulb went off. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. I am a craft geek. I mean, I just really, really am. And I thought about this. I had a written interview recently asking about craft, and I just every essay when I conceive of an essay, I mean, I'm gonna start speaking, I guess, generally, and maybe we'll get into the nitty gritty. But when I start, I'm always still formulating ideas for my next projects, and we'll talk about that. But when I think of the idea, immediately my head is just like, what is this going to look like? Like, what's it going to look like on the page? So it's almost, and I'm not an artist. I'm simply not. But I think very visually about what the page is going to look like, and how the story is just going to go, like what comes first and why and all this stuff. So I think, all of that to say, like, yes, craft is always in my mind. Like I used to think of the idea of an essay as just like, you know, beginning, middle, end, which, I mean, in some ways that's it. And it's simplistic form, but there's just so many, like, what is the shape of it? What is the shape? So I'm always thinking about shape. And to answer the question about what all of it was, because again, I was working like discreetly. I never was thinking, and I think that was helpful to me, honestly. If I had like conceived, and by the way, I'm doing it differently this time. Like, I have two book projects that I really have a firm idea of what they're going to be, and I'm kind of scared about that because I have an idea. And then with Nola Face, I didn't. I just sort of like winged it, and it ended up working out because of the back end labor of like then going back and putting it in some order. But thinking about like the discrete different essays, probably the one that was most difficult was exercises, because this is an essay that is sort of an ekphrastic essay. It's we've talked about ekphrasis before. It's kind of based upon Raymond Queneau's Exercises in Style. And so it kind of mirrors that book itself, but it's a tough subject. It's about, you know, kind of falling out with my father, who, it's weird that we had a falling out because we were never really together because he didn't really, anyway, parents divorced at a young age, kind of weekend dad, then a never dad, then came back to live with me after Hurricane Katrina. And you know the story, Jason, which is, it's what conspired in that house is tragic and comic, I guess I'll just say. But putting that essay together was hard because I didn't know how to tell it. And I think that going just basically kind of copying one of my favorite books at the time, exercise and style, copying the form of that helped me do it. And by the way, this is a good time to interject. My father did read the book. I did find out that after he gave me this review, which I'm going to give you the review, he told me that he admitted after he gave me the review, he said, well, he did flip through only to read the parts that he was in. But he said, but tell me how this review works. He said, I only liked the parts that I was in. If the whole book were about me, it would be a bestseller. That's what he said. And then he was like, I tried to read some of the other ones. Didn't hold my interest. So this is Roy Champagne. That's him. So writing about those more difficult things, I think Nice Lady was another one, like just difficult, heavier topics were hard, but always, I mean, I think whatever, I don't know if we're giving pro tips here, but like the stuff, I feel like I know that my students have a writing project and sometimes it's hard and they're dealing with tragedy and they're like, but I have to do this. And sometimes it's like, man, you just need time. You just like work on it. I'm not saying don't work on it, but when the shit gets hard, pull back, you know, like time sometimes answers some of the craft questions that I have. Like it's not abandoning. I always like to come back to the work, but just like this idea that writers making progress equals like more words and adding and adding and adding. No, sometimes it's simply sitting with something, looking at it. That's all work. It's hard for writers to really understand that. I still feel, I don't know, do you still feel guilt sometimes? Like some of my summer writing days are like, I'm looking at this stuff. I'm not adding. Like there's, so I don't know. I don't know how you feel about that.
Guilt is tough. I mean, of course, as writers, we always lie to ourselves that like, you know, our bullshitting is research. You know, we always say,
that's true. That's true.
Where, you know, it's, you know, if I'm, you know, watching tennis in the summer, it's like, oh, well, I wrote an essay about it, so this counts. And so, no, it doesn't. I'm watching tennis to get away from doing my syllabus building for the summer. But I think one of the things you mentioned about time is something that gets a little bit tricky because, you know, in our field, you mentioned the idea of, you know, earlier, the idea of kind of getting on the market where sometimes there is that push to say, well, I need to be timely. Or if you're shopping a book, there can be the expectation. And, you know, even when we talk about the idea of kind of identity in some ways, there can be the expected things for you to write about where, of course, you must have a thought on this as a Latina academic woman, or of course, you must have a thought on this as a person who claims New Orleans or someone who claims the South. And, you know, when there was in a lot of cases, you know, a lot of conversations, you know, when in the early parts of the pandemic, when you saw people jumping to say, you know, let's teach the pandemic and let's have a pandemic syllabus. And, you know, COVID was 2 months old, or, you know, in some, even now when it's the idea of, you know, you must have a, you know, a piece of writing in response to the global military industrial complex. And
absolutely,
the idea of taking time, you know, can you talk, well, for you and Nola Face, were there certain essays that you felt you could approach and write fairly quickly? And then were there other essays you felt like you needed to take that time with? And was it, whether it was based on craft, based on subject matter, any of those things?
Yeah. That's so great. And I think that's really true. Yeah. It's weird. It's like every, do you feel this way? Either as a poet or an essayist, like you're, every new discrete idea that I begin working on, I'm like, this shit ain't gonna work. It's not gonna work. Like, I'm not gonna figure this out. I'm not gonna figure it out. Like, what? And then like, I'm stubbornly still doing it. I'm like, oh. And then like maybe 2 days later, I'm like, oh, well, I figured a little something out. And like, that's how I progress. So that to say, yes, I feel like some of the essays did take years. Now this, when I say years, I'm watching tennis sometimes, Jason. I'm doing other things. I'm having children. I'm teaching. I'm doing other stuff. But like the exercises essay I just mentioned, the Nice Lady essay, which is about race and a carjacking, and it's like very, very cringe inducing. Like even the fact that that probably took the longest, right? Honestly. But others, weirdly, I would just be given prompts for. The one that comes to mind is the essay that I won the March Faxness essay writing competition for. It was, I knew I had to have an essay done because I got in this draft to write one of Andrew Monson's March Xmas essays. And this was the Faxmas year, the year that it was about writing about songs that are covers. So I wrote about Amy Mann's One, which is a cover song. And I wrote that essay like in 2 weeks, which for me is not done. And I think it's still deep and like meaningful and like all the things, but I just wrote it quickly because I had a certain amount of time to do it. I think I like outlined and did all that bullshit for like about a month, but like actual writing, it took 2 weeks. A couple of other essays are like that. Well, the introduction, I mean, I wrote that super fast. Like I wrote that fast because I was like, I was on the time deadline. Like I was like, I have to get this. I need to get on the market. Like I needed to get this going. It had to happen. So I wrote that one quickly, and I can think of several others, but just like, it really depends on, like you mentioned, if it's the harder the subject matter for me, it's just the longer it's going to take. And I think also because the subject matter doesn't immediately, when it's difficult, when it's something maybe traumatic, the form that to me is always a linchpin for the essay, it's harder to come by for me. It's not, I don't know exactly how it's going to shape up. So I'm just kind of like starting off, I just like, pouring every idea out I have about the subject, and so then it's just a big mess, and then it's like, how do you shape this into something? So yeah, the more difficult content made it take longer, but it wasn't just because of the content, it was because of the form. And then I think if there are other things that maybe they've been in my head for so long and I've thought about the form already, that when it comes out it's just quicker. And I think the Amy Mann one essay was one of those, and there's others, but yeah.
Yeah, and for people who don't know, the March Xmas competition.
Competition,
it's almost half competition, maybe half party.
It's party, yeah.
Each year it's put together. And each year it's based on, you know, writing essays in response to music, and there's a certain theme. You know, sometimes it can be themes based on a certain year, sometimes it's themes based on a certain genre. Yeah. And, you know, mentioning the idea of kind of writing, you know, from that perspective, you said, you know, that came together in about 2 weeks versus longer stuff. For you, and then you also mentioned the idea of kind of maybe the traumatic experiences maybe took a little bit longer. This is going to kind of go into our next question. You mentioned some future stuff, but you mentioned, you know, you did writing, but of course you weren't writing in the delivery room. You were busy being a mom. And maybe you're not writing when you're dropping off snacks to summer camp. And depending on who we're asking, that means you're not grinding hard enough. As a real writer, you're supposed to write every day, mm-hmm. and you're supposed to sacrifice so much of your life so that you can write. And I'm not questioning what works and what doesn't work. Of course, for all of us, our approach to art is the way we approach it, kind of how we want to approach this monster, this relationship, whatever you want to call it. But for you, you mentioned the times you thought about quitting and the times you thought about kind of revamping your writing. You mentioned Hurricane Katrina. You mentioned the Tuscaloosa tornado, April 27th, 2011. Mm-hmm. And obviously, I mean, in the book, you mentioned the idea of kind of, you know, how motherhood affected the way you looked at things and affected identity building. And so for you, when it comes down to kind of identity as a writer, again, we started this conversation mentioning that, you know, in some cases, your identity has changed as you moved into a new academic position.
Yeah.
You've moved into maybe a new position as a writer, as I hold this book in my hand. Mm-hmm. And so for you, when it comes down to looking at these different sections of your writing, whether it is moving from the 7-year-old with the journal to the undergraduate student, to the person who didn't know if they wanted to keep doing this writing mumbo jumbo, to now writer, with a great book from an academic press, who's teaching in a renowned MFA program at the University of Alabama. Do you feel like you approach the page any differently, or do you feel like there are parts of you that approach the page the same way, no matter these different stages for you?
Oh, that's so wonderful, Jay. I think the thing. Well, as I've mentioned before, I'm always humbled before the page. That has never changed. Again, I feel every time I approach a new project, whether it's a big book length one or just individual small parts of that book, I feel terrified. But then at the same time, and I think this is something that has come to me over time, and I do think, and thank you for mentioning it. I mean, I think it's something, for me, the ultimate act of creation was becoming a mother. I watched it happen. You know, from reading the book, I didn't request this, but I was asked, do you want a mirror? And I said, yes. I didn't know that I wanted it, but I watched my daughter come out of me. I mean, I saw that, and that was profoundly, disgusting and also moving. It was like, you know, your parts grow, and it's crazy. It's crazy to watch a human emerge from a vagina. But it was wonderful. And I think that was really, for me, after that, I was like, I've done for me the physically and emotionally most difficult and profound thing that my body could do. And so now I'm a fucking right. Like, I was like that really kickstarted me into, like, you know, people are like, oh, you have a baby. And it's, and I did. And I mean, I was like with her, I don't think I put her down for 8 months. She slept on my body for the first 8 months of her life. This is no joke. We were always together, but I was also writing. It's weird. I was just like, look, I was like taking notes on like what was actually happening. By the way, also like writing down every time she shit, every time she ate, how long she ate, time between shits and eating. I mean, like just insane stuff like this, but that ultimate act of creation helped make other creation feel, I don't mean to say like, oh, it's just writing, who cares? Yes, writing is so meaningful and so difficult. But I think it helped me approach the page to be like, you've done creation before, you can do it again. It's always hard. It's always going to, but it's always there for you. I mean, it's always just, it's just you, for me, my process is, it's just me conversing with myself on the page and finding a way to invite a reader into that. So I think over time, it's just, so now when I start an essay, let me just say that I feel like I know my voice better. I think that helps. Like, I know the persona I want to create. It's different for each essay. Sometimes I'm putting out the more body side of myself. Sometimes I'm putting out a little more serious or academic side, but I always like, I feel now more in control of that voice, the thing that I want to say, what that I want to like override a certain discrete essay. So yeah.
Yeah. And I guess in some cases, when you've done the creation with a capital C, your writing maybe is a creation with a lowercase c, maybe the biggest lowercase c, as opposed to when you've survived with a capital S, when you talk about natural disasters, when we talk about any other type of disaster. You know, surviving a bad writing session maybe isn't the end of it.
You got it.
But you mentioned how you're approaching the page now, and you have talked a little bit about projects. And so one of the last questions we always like to ask on the podcast is, what's next? And so if you can you tell us a little bit about these new writing projects?
Yes, I can. I would love to. So I've got two. Again, first book, didn't know what the hell I was doing. No, like just, and then 10 years later, I think I have something. I don't know. I'm trying to think of the inception. Oh, this is what it was. So just doing, you're a pro wrestling guy. You're a sports guy. I've always been around sports. I'm from New Orleans, Saints fans, LSU fans my whole life. Like, this is my family. And I was always sort of the bookish person who thought like those two things were like mutually exclusive, like you're either a sports person or, I mean, you and like millions of others can attest to the fact that is insane. You can be bookish and also like sports, but you know, I was young and like sort of standing my ground, like this is my identity. I'm not like my family. But yes, I've been surrounded by Saints fans my whole life. And I was just kind of doing some research, and I forget why I was doing this, but I found out that the New Orleans Saints, who spent a large period of the 80s being referred to as the Aints, New Orleans Aints, because, and we had a baghead fan base. Fans started coming to the games. We were such an abysmal team. They would come to the stadium, they would come, this was televised, wearing bags over their heads. Well, this all started, the inception of this was with a local New Orleans sportscaster. His name was Buddy Deliberto. And he one day said the 1980 season, after six losses in a row, he came on air and was like, we're not the Saints, we're the Aints. He put a bag on his head. And the day he did that was the day I was born.
Oh, wow.
the day of my birth. And so I was thinking about all of my, now this is, that's kind of like a nice coincidence. Now I get to the dark part, but just, it's New Orleans, man. Like there's, it's a city of tragedies. All cities are tragic, I guess, in a way, but it's faced a lot of it in its long life. And I've lost a lot of people in it. And it's there. I've seen a lot of deaths of despair in that city. I've lost a lot of family and friends. And so I wanted to write something that commemorates them. So this book is called Lives of the Aints. And so it's sort of a memoir and profiles about some of these lost, my lost family members. And I kind of think of it as like a combo of Jesmyn Ward's Men We Reaped, which is like, that's, it's that, except hers is, you know, except she's Jesmyn Ward and I'm from Champaign, so quite different. But she's got this like beautiful memorial to these five men in her life. And then there's also another book, Marion Winnick's Book of the Dead, or Glen Rock Book of the Dead. It's a couple books that are also like mini profiles. So those, hers are really short. Jesmyn Ward's are really long. I feel like my profiles are somewhere in the middle. But I'm just thinking about also like it's about these people that I've lost, and also the Saints, the actual players, because we know Drew Brees, you know the people who make the Hall of Fame, and there are hundreds and hundreds who get lost to time. You don't know who the hell they were. At one time they were being revered. And that's the thing about professional sports, I think, that always bothered me, is that bodies are used up. And we love them for a minute, and then we don't love them anymore. And so this was just kind of my way of being like, I love sports, but I want to remember the people that we don't remember anymore. So I'm doing research on old Saints that have been forgotten. And so that's, all of that is being intermixed together, the profiles. So that's great. And then I just have, so that's my big thing that's causing me like a lot of like gastro problems, because it's a wonderful, I love it, but it's also hard to write. It's hard to write about people that we've lost. Meanwhile, though, the Saints research is really interesting. And I'm also working on another sort of, I'm calling it NOLA Phase 2. It's not NOLA Phase 2. I actually do have a title for it, but it's sort of like a sequel in some sense to these, it's just another essay collection that's focused in on the body and the aging body. And how, like, it's just, you know, when you're in your mid-40s, suddenly you're like, things don't work the same. Why do I look different? Like, you can watch things. I watch gravity happen. And it's funny. And I watch it happen to everyone else. And it's great. And so I'm writing kind of an essay collection about that. So, but when one gets hard, I move to the other, and kind of vice versa. And so I'm actually being really productive, because when one gets hard, I just move on over and toggle back and forth, but they're both great fun to write. And I have no idea when any of this will be done, but I'm doing the thing. I'm giving myself stickers. I'm working a little bit every day, but it's been a joy. So yeah.
All right. That was Jason McCall's conversation with Brooke Champaign. You can check out a copy of NOLA Face, Latina's Life in the Big Easy, wherever you buy books. And you can check out Jason's essay collection, Raised by TV Sets, over at autofocuslit.com/books. And that's also where you can find a t-shirt with the logo for this podcast on it, which is currently $10 off the normal price. And it's a great way to support the podcast if you'd like to find a way to do that with a little bit of money. And other than that, thanks for listening. Till next time.